Please welcome SDPA's Conference Medical Director and Assistant Professor of Dermatology at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Dr. Arash Mostaghimi.
Hey guys, good to see the people here. I wasn't sure how many folks would be left. I know there are well, first, but let me say what a wonderful conference this has been. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for coming to Boston, which is a city that where I live and that I love. And let's give a big round of applause to the people that helped set up the conference. Most of them are in the back here. Thank you, guys. Secondly, I want to say I know exactly the type of people that are in the room today. There's three types. Okay, one is the most hardcore of the hardcore. You, I appreciate. They're trying to squeeze out every drop of education in your time here. The second group is the people that already checked out of the hotel, like can't go anywhere because their luggage is like in the back of the room. And then the third group, I'm not going to ask you to identify yourselves. You went to half of a talk on Thursday. You realize you didn't go to any of the rest of the conference. Now you have to tell people at home what you learned. So like, I have to get something in before I go. Whatever brings you here, I'm happy that you're here. All right, welcome. So this is a type of lecture I've never given before. It's a little bit of an extension of the lecture I gave yesterday that some of you may have been at about the future of dermatology. It's really talking about how we need to react to the world around us, what we owe to ourselves, what we owe to each other, what we owe to our patients as we navigate an increasingly complex and fraught world within medicine. I'm going to tell you up front, I'm not going to actually answer this question, which is a wonderful way, right, to begin this talk. I'm going to propose a framework for thinking about it. I have a variety of disclosures, again, related to alopecia research, not related specifically to this talk. So yesterday we spoke about the future of dermatology. We talked about challenges facing reimbursement. We talked about changes in the workforce, right? Large part of that change in the workforce being you guys and the increased number of PAs and NPs providing dermatologic care. Also the fact that we had more private equity hiring, more private practice hiring particularly for PAs. And we talked about the potential of AI, which I framed in a very positive sense, suggesting that the early changes that we're going to see with AI are likely to, if done appropriately, eliminate a lot of the rote tasks that we don't like, okay? And I give the same caveat, though. These are germane to what we're talking about today. We're not going to talk about them specifically again. I'm going to get the same caveat that I gave at the beginning of the last talk, that I'm an intensely optimistic person. I believe our best days are ahead of us, and I believe that it is incumbent on us to ensure that those days ahead of us are better. That's not guaranteed. That's part of our responsibility. But a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is going to have a negative tone at first, so please bear with me as we go through it. So the current state of medicine, I would argue, is not that hot. You know, this field is changing rapidly. I've been out of residency 10 years. It feels I've aged 100 years in that time, but it's only been 10 years. It's amazing to see how quickly the field is changing. So here's a report from the Massachusetts Medical Society. It's a physician-based report. We're going to get into PA data as well, but I wanted to talk about this because this has a lot of granular level data that I think will apply and will resonate with you guys. So burnout among Massachusetts physicians is super high. So the circled numbers are people that are experiencing burnout. So a little bit over half. The people on the right are on the green, the 12% are worried about burnout, but they don't feel like they're there yet. And the only 9% are like, I'm totally good. That's the people on the left. And this burnout beyond the personal, so we can talk extensively. I know there's been other conversations at this conference about the personal tolls of burnout. We don't need to talk about how burnout is bad. We know that. But from a system standpoint, from a society standpoint, if people don't like the job, if people don't feel fulfilled from the job, they're not going to want to work at that job. So if you see here, what's the likelihood that you're going to reduce the number of hours you work? So the one already on the right have already 25% already reduced their hours. 11, 12, 8%, so about another 30% have said that they're moderate to very likely to reduce their hours. This is remarkable. I always felt this was like a little bit of an empty threat. Oh, I'm going to leave medicine. Like everybody's always saying, I'm about to leave medicine. Anything you read is like about half of people are about to leave medicine. I think half of people wish that they could leave medicine, unfortunately, right? But some of them may not do it. But look, 14% said definitely, 12% said likely, 15% said moderate. Like none of these are particularly good numbers. Age is also really interesting. You have these like hopeful people. The blue is, this is showing you just the two sides. Blue is completely not burned out, and orange is completely burned out, okay? So when you're starting off on the far left, less than 5%, 5 years, people are not burned out. They enjoy their work. They're still excited. You know, some of them get burned out, about 12%. I found this 5 to 10 years interesting that like almost everybody had some level of burnout. And I think what happens over time is you get a survivorship bias, right? If you've been there 30 years, like of course 18% don't have burnout because they probably they're the survivors, right? They're the people that made it through this entire system and worked for it. Again, there's a difference between we make these things personal, right? You need to take better care of yourself. You need to exercise more. You need to eat better. You need to do yoga. You need to meditate. You need to spend time with your kids. You need to reduce your hours at work. And you also need to go on more vacation with the money you don't have now because you reduce your hours at work, right? You need to make sure that you get your charting in time, answer the messages over time, but don't do too much of that because you don't get paid for that because you got to see patients, right? So we've taken a systemic problem, right? And we've made it a personal problem. This is not a perfect analogy, right? But we've had an evolution in our society where we've realized that a lot of the things that lead to socioeconomic differences, particularly on the basis of race, are due to systematic issues in the way that our society is constructed, right? This is given the term systemic racism. The reason that these one-off issues in medicine don't work to fix your burnout or to make you feel better is that the entire system is designed for you to work and to get burned out. That's why working at the margins doesn't fix the issue of burnout, right? Now, the hard part is that working at the margins is all you can do if you're a taxed system. To completely reconsider and recreate and redo a system, it's incredibly complicated, incredibly costly, and I'm not sure at this point that we have the willpower to do it. So the burnout is gendered. More women feel more burned out than men. Looking at dermatology overall is a super female field, right, among medicine, and that's reflected in the membership of this organization and audience as well. And then also women are more likely to want to leave and to move away from medicine. And this, again, has two substantial issues. One, from just the question of equity and equality, that's an issue, right? We're not able to accommodate people from different backgrounds. But secondly, speaking purely not from a humanistic standpoint, but from a purely mechanical standpoint, if the number of women is increasing dramatically in our field, and yet this field doesn't work for them, or medicine doesn't work for them, the consequences of them leaving or reducing their hours is going to be much more substantial because much more of the work is being done by women more and more each year. So I'm going to present to you now data from two different burnout and depression reports. I like this because these are like dual reports, both from Medscape. They each had about 1,000 people that they asked. And this is like I like the difference between the picture they use for the doctor and the picture they use for the PA. But I think the feeling is pretty much the same between the two of them. So I'm going to start out with physician data. They're slightly different surveys. So I'm going to start off with physician data. Are you burned out and or depressed? So 53% burned out, 23% depressed for physicians. This is physician data. Which are burned out? Well, there's a reason people love dermatology is that dermatology is actually one of the most fun specialties to be a part of, right? I made some not so kind comments about primary care yesterday when I was at the podium. You can see they're much higher on the list, right? ED at the top, internal medicine second, right? But still, even though we're doing better, we're 50% burnout is not so awesome. It's like you got the highest grade on the test, but you got a C. So, I mean, are you going to be proud? I don't know. So they say, what contributes to your burnout? Think about your own lives for a moment. Think about what you do. It says, too many bureaucratic tasks, lack of respect for coworkers, too many work hours, insufficient compensation, and lack of control autonomy. This is what the physicians are saying. So what about the PAs? So the number here, the bottom two are like female, then male, right? So the black is total, and then female and male. So when you look at this, it says burned out 37% and depressed 6%. I'm like, oh, that's much better than the 53% of physicians who are burned out and like the 20% that are depressed. And then I scroll down on the survey because they have another one that says both burned out and depressed. So, so not as rosy. It's actually very, very similar. It's a very similar result. And when you look at the reasons, yesterday I made a big point that we're in it together, right? That there's no real difference. There's maybe a difference in title, maybe a difference in training, but working together, it's the same things. Too many bureaucratic tasks, not enough money, lack of respect, too many hours at work, right? And then you have the EHR, some other stuff there. And leaving the profession, a third yes, 40% no. And then one thing that's really different about your guys' jobs than ours is that you guys come and enter and exit the workforce a little bit more easily. So 30% have left, and then they ended up having to come back. So when you compare the two together, right, again, they're not exactly the same survey, but bureaucratic tasks was at the top. This was my argument for the salvation of AI, that we can actually hopefully reduce a lot of that. Lack of respect, too many work hours, insufficient compensation. They're identical, the top four, slightly different order, right? Slightly different percentages. EHR is a little bit higher for physicians than PAs, may reflect the number of patients seen, which is a little bit different. But the rest is very similar. So I'm interested, you have all these are the top four things, right? These are the problems, right? I just want to look at this. There's a problem, it's the number one problem, too many bureaucratic tasks, right? Number two problem for PA, number four problem for physicians, insufficient compensation. What's the number one answer that we say, how do you fix it? You give more money. That's like the food here sucks. What should we do? You should give it to me cheaper. Like why? What's going on? And I think that is a crisis of imagination. It's because we see the limits of the world that we're in, that we can't think if we can figure out like a number, we can say, okay, you give me more money, but you see that the problems of burnout, the challenges are so vast, right? That we can't imagine other solutions. Lighter patient load, more support staff, exactly the same work schedule and support staff, exactly the same issues on both ends. Greater respect on both sides, right? A new job, I like a new job. Maybe sometimes it's specific, almost exactly the same, 14 to 15%. So I think a lot about this. I think about, okay, well, we're all saying we're burned out, roughly the same reason. We're saying we're burned out because there's too many things. Nobody said, like, patient care wasn't at the top. I don't like my patients. Wasn't like, oh, that's the reason I don't like to do this. I don't like medicine. Nobody's saying that, right? The reasons that you are encouraged to enter this and to do this are good. And the person you were before you were burnt out is the same person you are now. Your inclination, your desire to help, all those things are the same. We're identifying the same issues. We're also identifying not a solution, right? We're identifying a solution that doesn't make much sense. So it reminds me of this quote from Steve Jobs. They asked Steve Jobs about the iPhone. The question was, did you have a focus group for the iPhone? And he says, some people say, give the customers what they want, but that's not my approach. Our job is to figure out what they're going to want before they do. I think Henry Ford once said, if I'd asked the customers what they wanted, they would have told me a faster horse. People don't know what they want until you show it to them. I don't know if this is a real quote from Ford, because they also said, like Edison said, people want a better candle, right? But the idea being that at a certain point, you cannot optimize the horse any better. You can't make a candle burn any brighter. You have to think of a whole different model of transportation, a whole different model of providing illumination. I think that's where we are. I don't think that a more optimized version of what we have, giving me a few more bucks, giving you a few more dollars, I'm not sure is a long-term approach that we're looking for. So I've talked a lot about us, but how patients feel. Patients feel bad for us. They're sympathetic towards us. 71% worry that the demands on their provider are too great. 47% feel that we're burnt out. They're incredibly accurate because almost exactly half of us are burnt out. But they feel it. And look at the grades, B, C. 70% feel failed by the healthcare system. I think about my own interaction with the healthcare system, which fortunately are not that plentiful, right? I've been lucky that I haven't. But every time either myself or my family has had to get some healthcare, what a hassle. We are like the most educated people. I know a million doctors. I have access to insurance, I have access to money, I have access to transportation, I can take time off. And it's still almost impossible to get what I need from who I need when I need it. Imagine if I didn't speak English. Imagine if I had worked an hourly job that I, when I left to see you, I had to stop working to do that. I had to take two buses we have many lovely things in Boston. The transportation system is not one of them, right? Think about those struggles. And when you come see you, I have to wait. I'm not upset. I understand why my patients wait. I understand why your patients wait. I don't take it personally. I'm not sure people understand, though. All right, so those are all the problems. So the question is, so what do we do about it? What do we do about it? So I have a framework to think about this. This is Albert Hirschman, who is he's an economist. And he grew up actually in Nazi Germany, and he had to escape Nazi Germany and then came to the United States and then did a lot of research looking at when states are failing, when things are collapsing, when organizations or institutions are collapsing, what are the approaches of the people within that organization or institution to change? So the model he came up with is like a behavioral economics model. It's called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. He wrote a book on this. The plus part is based on additions that have been made to his theory over the last 40 years. He published his book in the 70s. So in asking the question, how do people respond to decline in organizations? Well, one option is to exit. And that's what we're seeing here. I'm like, peace. I'm out of medicine. I don't want to be part of this any longer. Another one is voice. They articulate their concerns with the hope of improving the organization. So you can think about this politically. You can think about this whatever institution or organization you want to think about. Loyalty. Stay with the organization and hope that improves over time. So these were his three initial approaches or things that he said that people do. And the one that was added was neglect. So just not doing a very good job, reducing work efforts, paying less attention to quality, just extracting yourself emotionally while the world around you collapses. So summarized, exit is leaving, voice is changing, loyalty is waiting, and neglect is something that I don't think we had a term for until like 3 years ago. I think it's quiet quitting. I think you just don't care anymore. You're just kind of going through the motions, right? I'm going to say an aside here. Somebody asked me a great question yesterday because we were talking about private equity and the role of how many PAs work for private equity companies, and I was forecasting that as the interest rates have changed, some of the economic consequences for private equity may change over time. And the person's question was, what do I do? Basically, what am I supposed to do? And my answer was, I'm not sure, right? But I think this is actually the right framework to look at it. We're going to talk the rest of the talk about a macro level. We're going to talk about the United States healthcare system. But for each of you that are at an academic institution, at a private practice, at a private equity group, this framework is how you can think about if you're seeing that your institution or organization is starting to collapse, what happens. And I think when we talk about what's the advantage of being at a physician-owned practice or a practice where there's a partnership model is that your quality of your voice has a lot more value there, right? You have a lot more agency in that sense versus like not speaking for every private equity group, but many private equity groups for whom that employee status is much set. So I just wanted to, if that person is here in this room or other people had that same question, I would use this framework to think about how you deal with institutions that are changing in general. So we as physicians have been here before. Again, I'm talking macro. I'm talking about the whole healthcare system. But we did this when it came to electronic health records. Electronic health records came, they began to disrupt what we did. And we had to decide to change fundamentally what we do, right? I talked about it yesterday. The interaction with many physicians is with their computer. The patient happens to be on the side, right? There's all these like incredibly sad pictures of like kids draw pictures like their pediatrician. It's like the pediatrician at the computer. Like it's like the saddest thing, right? That's how they see it. That's how the world is for them. So EHRs are broadly an exercise in failure, right? AMA calls EHR fixes a national imperative after doctors give an F for usability. Okay, Like, this is 2019. We're like, what are we up to? Like a D in usability? I think about scribes, right? Think about every other technology you use in your life, right? I recently went to the West Coast to give a talk. I was in a rural part of Oregon. And I was driving, and I had never been there before. I used my GPS. And my GPS not only tells me exactly where to go, it tells me, like, the price of gas, like, if I want to go to a restaurant. It tells me all the information I need, everything perfectly there, right? Brigham and Women's Hospital, Mass General Brigham, paid $2.5 billion to install an electronic health record, okay? It is so bad that we have to hire scribes to interface with the technology because literally people don't want to do their jobs anymore, right? People are driven to depression because the technology is so bad. Imagine if you had to do a Google search and you're like, I'm going to hire somebody to ask the computer for me whenever I want to do a search, right? This is what we have accepted as a standard for us. Death by 1,000 clicks, where electronic health records went wrong. So people provided, did the same model, EVLN, right? They exited, physicians leaving the profession over EHRs, right? And there's a whole generation of folks. When I stood that, I showed a graph yesterday of physicians reduced in the workforce. There's a whole slew of them reduced right around the time EHRs became required. They're like, I don't want to engage with this. A lot of voice, a lot of people who did research, wrote about it, called attention to the idea that, hey, these EHRs are problematic, it's hard to use, they're causing issues, and they're not interoperable, right? So this is a 2018 physician survey, a call to action on physician burnout focused specifically on electronic health records. A lot of people said, man, we just gotta stick with it. It's gonna work out. That's the loyalty model, right? Current design problems can be corrected over time by EHR vendors, Chan says. Chan's a physician in this article. And expects the fur over EHRs to dissipate as annoying and time-consuming glitches are alerted. This dude is pretty loyal. It's 2017 as this article is written, right? I could have written it 3 days ago, right? And then neglect, right? Crappy notes, right? Like, okay, man, they're gonna make me do this. They make me record this. This person hasn't smoked in 40 years, but I still say they smoke every visit because I asked them once and like I just copy it over. Right, cut and paste, are these the real medicines they're on? I have no idea. Nobody's looked at this list, right? So 50% of note data is copied from previous notes. This is probably better now with the newer notes that we write that don't require as much documentation of background, but it's still a major issue. So my question is, what are you doing today? And you can decide you. I want you to think about you as yourself. I want you to think about you as your practice. I want to think about you as a society. I want to think about you as an institution, right, of people taking care of patients with dermatology. So exit, are you considering leaving the workforce? Are you exiting parts of it? Like, insurance sucks, should I move to cash pay? Do I not take Medicaid? Am I changing the people I'm taking care of or the ways I'm taking care of because I just can't bear to engage with it? I'm not judging you for any of this, okay? I want to be very clear. There's not a place of judgment. I'm just bringing up questions. Are you adding your voice? Are you active in professional organizations? Well, you're here, right? But a lot of professional organizations that we're talking about are not like this organization per se, but your state and local organizations, right? One's advocating for not just the role of PAs or the role of dermatologists, but for healthcare overall, right? Do you advocate for healthcare workforce and patients? Loyalty, or are you just doubling down and say, hey man, I can't change this? These are, I think, are the people that are asking for more money. I'm fine with asking for money. I ask for more money all the time. But these are guys asking for more money in response to the challenges that they're facing at work. And I think they're like, if I work a little longer, look a little bit harder, get this money, then maybe I can actually think about exiting or have some provisions for the future. Are you focused on managing your own situation while waiting for things to improve? Or some of us, and I think there's a deep shame with this, but I think each of us can see in our lives at a certain point where there's been an issue of neglect. Are you mailing it in? Not necessarily in a way that I'm gonna get sued, I'm totally neglecting my patients, but am I able to maintain the quality and vigor and respect and level of focus that a 15-year-old, 15 years ago, 15-year-old, for some of you that might be the same, When I was in college, when I was starting PA school, whatever I was doing, if that younger version of me saw me now, would they think I'm mailing it in? If my first day of work me saw me now, would they think I'm mailing it in? Are you cutting corners? Just focus on getting what you can while you can. Well, it's hard to see 12 patients in a day, but maybe I'll see 14, maybe I'll see 16, maybe I'll see 18. Screw it, I'll see 20. That's fine. The prior authorization just doesn't quite get in. The note's not quite written, right? You're delayed in calling people back, right? These are not your fault. These are not individual people's fault. But these are, if a system is designed to make you act in a certain way, again, at a population level, people are going to be inclined this way. We're not the only people in the system. The question is, what are our patients doing? Well, some of them are exiting, right? What's the rise of direct-to-consumer care? Why do you go directly to telemedicine online with some random person somewhere? It's because you don't have time to wait or pay that high deductible or do that. A patient, I had a patient call to make an appointment with me. The next available appointment was in February of 2024. What the hell is that? Is that good for anybody? There's no way. There's no way that is useful for that patient to have a visit in February of 2024. And although I like to attribute it to my popularity, that was for the whole practice. It wasn't even just me. Are they going to concierge practice? Are they listening to TikTok influencers? Are they going to alternative therapies, right? Concierge practices are fine. I have nothing personally against them. They're not a scalable model for providing care. The people that don't get care, again, I measure our healthcare system not by me, like rich white dude with insurance health access. I measure it by the people that have the lowest level of socioeconomic status, right? How are they able to access care? I can get care however and whenever I need to by using social capital and real capital to do it, right? But that's not the point of this. The point of this is, what do you do with the people who are not able to access these things? Are they adding their voice? Are they supporting us in their effort? Those are those people I feel bad for my doctor, 70% worried for us, 50% think we're done that. Or are they using their voice against us? Are they villainizing us, engaging in anti-science, anti-medicine discourse? I would say this is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think the system needs to be changed, but a lot of people blame us, right? How often do you have a patient, who here in the last 2 months has had a patient call and complain vociferously either about you in a patient review or directly to your practice about a drug that you busted your ass to get, but the insurance ultimately denied? It happens to me all the time, right? It happens to me all the time, where you're taking the blame for what other folks have done. Some of them are sticking with us. This is a guy coming to see me in February. He'll stick it out. Dealing with medication shortages, prior authorizations, and lack of care. Or are they dealing with neglect, personal neglect, right? Often you see, like, why didn't you come in earlier? Well, you stop asking that question because you realize the reason they didn't come in earlier is because, like, maybe they called and you had your next appointment was February 2024. It's not an option. Are they just accruing medical debt, not getting the medications that we prescribe them? Again, I'm not faulting the patients for these actions. These are things that their hands have been forced, right? Nobody goes to see the doctor and says, I'm going to go see the doctor with the intent of getting prescribed a medicine that I never pick up or never use, right? That's just nobody, that's not the, I don't think, the logic flow of folks. So what should we be doing? Well, let's talk first about what we want to accomplish. So what do we want to accomplish? And I think there will be unity for this. I think we want to maintain quality care and eliminate moral injury. Moral injury is when you are forced to act, either you witness something or you act in a way because of your institution, of the system that you're in, that is against your own moral instinct, right? So when you're not able to spend the time that you want with your patients, if you're not able to provide the level of quality of care that you want with your patients because you're running through patients, running through things, you're frazzled at the end of the day, that's moral injury, right? When you know that somebody needs a treatment or therapy, but you can't give it to them because there's complicated step therapy that doesn't make any sense, right? That's moral injury. And I think that is actually at the core of much of our burnout. When people say bureaucratic tasks, I think that's a catch-all for things that get in the way of me doing the things that I need to do to get people better. We need to ensure equitable access without roadblocks. So again, I'm not faulting anybody here if you don't take Medicaid. You are doing an act of charity in 90% of the U.S. when you take a Medicaid patient. At my institution, one of the benefits of being at a large nonprofit is that we end up taking all types of insurance, and my personal salary is not incumbent on the types of patients that I see. They're like, oh, how great, what a wonderful thing to do. Whenever we build a new building, a new healthcare building, it's in a suburb where there's no public transportation. Everybody around that suburb is white, privately insured, higher socioeconomic status. So although we certainly will see anybody that comes to that clinic, and we don't have specific slots or waits for Medicaid, we are deliberately designing a system, or not deliberately, or indirectly designing a system, maybe it is deliberate, depending on how strongly you feel, that because of the financial obligations that we're under, makes it so that those people can't even come anyway, right? So charity does not scale, okay? It's an important part of what do? We provide care for the patients, but in the end, we have bills to pay. How do we make sure that we have the appropriate systems in place to ensure that equitable access? For us individually, we want pay commensurate with our expertise, with the number of years and effort and hours we put into this. And also, this is a new thing, right? One that is holds up with inflation. My wife's job, she works at a multinational organization, and they look at the local inflation in each country, and then they adjust your salary standard annually based on the local inflation in each country. So the people in Japan and Hong Kong and Australia and Germany all get different amounts of salary adjustment. And that's not beyond like the actual pay raises. That's just to maintain your pay where it is. So she asked me, what does your organization do? How did your salary get adjusted this year? It was like a nonsensical question. It didn't. Nothing happened, right? Not getting adjusted next year either, right? If I want to get adjusted, what do I have to do? I see more patients, right? That's the squeezing a little bit more out of the toothpaste, right? We want a quality workplace environment. We want a place where we feel safe, where we feel comfortable, where we have the resource and ability to take care of our patients in the way that we want. And in doing all these things, I think at the core, I think we have a lot of pride in the work that we do and the people that we are. And we need to ensure that if we don't take care of this, we're not going to create a situation where there'll be people after us to come and take over for us. I feel that I have a deep responsibility, as I spoke about yesterday, to ensuring the care of dermatologic patients in the United States moving forward. Part of that responsibility is not just in what I do today, but how we help set up the field so other people can do it tomorrow. So I think, like, do we want a better horse? Like, is this what we want? Maybe a better horse? I think maybe we want something else. And I think that the only people that are able to, so think about the perspective of all the people that are in the healthcare system. You have insurance companies which are moving money. You have hospitals, those organizations that are providing care, sometimes with a charitable aim, sometimes with a nonprofit aim, often for profit. You have private equity showed up just because there's money to be made, right? In the end, the only people in the entire healthcare system that have our complete responsibility, right? And what when you at the end of the day say, am I successful in my job, right? The definition of success in your job is if your patients get better, right? The definition of success in my job is if I can make my patients get better, right? It's not that, oh, I brought in this much business, I made this much sales, I generated this much revenue. Other people, that's their jobs, right? They're actually, and I didn't show the picture of the number of administrators versus the number of clinicians, but there's like five of them for each one of us now, right? But if we, the people at the front lines, the people that have the patient specifically in mind, again, I'm not ascribing ill intent on anybody, but their obligations are different, right? Our obligations to the person in front of us, if we are not the people advocating for either the best horse that we can with the present thing or for a whole new system, I'm not sure that that will happen. I'm not sure that others are incentivized to go down that path. So what should we be doing? So we should be advocating directly for ourselves and our patients. As I said yesterday, I do not believe that advocating for ourselves is selfish. I believe that advocating for our field, its financial viability, and the quality of care that we provide directly leads to better outcomes for patients. If you are happier and better and more capable of doing your job, that's going to reflect in a schedule and a level of compassion and ability to deliver care that is better for all people, including our patients. We largely try to stay out of these. A lot of us do because it's embarrassing, right? If you don't want to be like, oh, we are rich people advocating for rich people. That's not it. We are advocating for our profession. We need to educate the public. Where is our voice? Now, not each of us needs to do each of these aspects. These are ideas of things that we should be doing as a group. But I think that if the public's view of healthcare is determined by their experience, well, their experience is crap, right? If their view is by how much their drugs cost in the pharmacy, that's crap. If it's their insurance costs going up, that's crap. We have to say, hey, there's a group of people that are on your side. It is us. These are the issues. This is how it is for us. When we try to provide you care, this is what is happening, right? This is what a prior authorization is. I'm not trying to not give you that medication. I literally wrote you that prescription. I never want to talk about this again. I want you to get it, and I want you to come back and be better. But when they're calling you 4, 5, 6 times, you don't have enough schedules because you can't hire enough because they went somewhere else, right? You don't have people answering the phones. They're calling you, and they're frustrated. It's not because of your actions, but they need to understand that how the system works and how they can work with us to help change it. We, as a profession, this is a lot for physicians and a lot for PAs, it's a little bit distributed differently, right? We need to strongly reconsider our employee status. We should go to practices increasingly. So again, I'm an academic. I'm not speaking for myself. I'm part of a massive operation. But working for other folks limits our control and it brings in fiduciary responsibilities, right? Responsibilities to outside shareholders that are not us that can really, over time, compromise how we live, how we practice, the care that we can provide. Not always, not in every situation, and not invariably. But I feel that the direction that we're going, if these pressures continue, this is going to be more of a compromise for us. This is different if you are a part owner or the owner, or you're in a group that is owned largely by people that are patient facing, okay? And we used to be in this country, all physicians owned their own practices, that's how we rolled. Now 70 to 80%, depending on what you look at, of physicians are part of employees or employee models or large groups. I don't actually have the data for PAs. I imagine it's probably even more extreme than that. But we should really be thinking about this more broadly. And then for those of us that have employee status, this may seem a little bit radical. The residents at our hospital just unionized, right? They unionized because they were getting, everybody always assumed that in residency you have to get paid nothing and work terrible hours and suffer. It was almost a rite of passage. They threatened to unionize. Their salaries went up by 50% with the threat. Somehow people thought that the threatening to unionize, you gave them 50% more salary, that they would not unionize. They immediately unionized. I mean, that's what I would do, right? If the threat was that good, the rest are going to be that good as well. But we should really think about this as well. So we have a sense of professionality and a sense of commitment to our profession where almost employee status feels a little bit beneath us, right? We are there to take care of patients. Almost the work aspect of what we do is separate. But if you're increasingly in situations where larger employers are going to take advantage of us and put us in situations where it's not safe for us, not safe for our patients, or dealing with this level of burnout. For us, I feel burnout is the same as like when there's an accident on a machine line. It means it wasn't set up properly for us to do. At a certain point, it may make sense for us to begin to organize and to think about leveraging masses against the employer advantage. And as I mentioned yesterday, we need to engage with new models of care and technologies to ensure, this is a word of Osler, to ensure that the old art is incorporated into the new science. Also, we're talking about like the invention of X-ray, right? This guy, you know, it's like he was like, oh, this is going to really change things, you know, and it did, right? But think about how different the world is now, how much more rapidly it's changing, and you can say, okay, telemedicine is awesome, has a great place. I do virtual visits. Direct-to-consumer care has its place, right? But if these are done through the eye of business-based models that are meant to maximize either throughput or finances and not done with patient intent in mind or with our own benefit in mind, we will be compromised. It will end up in a place that we don't want. EHR was designed to optimize billing. It is the world's greatest billing machine. It sucks for patient care, right? Even the world's greatest EHR is still terrible, okay? That's because we ignored it, and the people who put it into place, the government and the business opportunity interests there, made huge amounts of money and had huge amounts of investment in it, and it ended up something that didn't work for us. We can't have that happen again. What we should not be doing is fighting with and between ourselves. And I mean that at every single level, within your practice, amongst PAs, between PAs and physicians, between dermatology and the outside world, and the other doctors. It is completely false. The idea that they're always like, you know, we need to shift money from primary care, from specialty groups and procedural things to primary care. We've heard this over and over, right? We're paying too much for procedure. We need to move money over to primary care. I totally agree that primary care should get paid more. Why does it need to come from us? Like, who made this up? This is like, there's like 10 pizzas out there, and they're like, this one pizza has to be split among everybody in this room. We're like, well, dude, don't worry about the 9 other pizzas, right? These are false narratives, right? So if you do that, then it makes it where we're at each other's throats. And when we're at each other's throats, we're not advocating for what's better for medicine overall. We cannot disengage. This is like the easiest thing to do. Like, man, that's somebody else's problem. I'm so burnt out. I'm tired. I'm doing this stuff. Like, the last thing I need is to, like, now, like, you know, go march in the streets or whatever, right? Some of you are looking at me very skeptically, right? Like, what? Come on, man. What am I supposed to do? Each one of us has our own way and ability to engage. We need to encourage ourselves to do that in a way that makes sense and is natural for you. We should not trade quick wins for long-term losses, right? We can't do things in the short term that make us a few extra bucks, make life a little bit easier, things along those lines, but we sell out the future, right? This is a long game, not just long in our own careers, but long over the course of generations of care providers. And finally, I doubt that many of us do this intentionally. We have to be very careful not to trade our integrity for an economic benefit. It is very, very easy to get on a slippery slope where, look, man, I need to make a few extra bucks. It's harder here. I want to cut back here. What are other ways I can make money? What are other ways I can make things faster? What are other ways I can do things better? And when we see these in the news, again, we see them for extreme cases, right? Extreme fraud, extreme issues. I don't think most of us either never are. I think in huge fraud you engage in intentionally. I'm talking about unintentional. Are things beginning to slip? Did I end up in a funny place? Am I the frog in the boiling water that is slowly getting warmer, but I'm not realizing it? So in the end, when I say, what do we owe to ourselves and our patients? I don't have the answer. This is my last slide. I think what we need to do is to, the two major issues I think that we have, the two major things that we can do is that first, we have to agree that there's a bigger item at play here, right? That this, our individual experiences and ideas and lives, right, are intertwined in this larger web. And it feels almost impossible to change the bigger picture. And in the very short term, me taking a little bit from you, you taking a little bit from me, us talking about percentages of what money is going to PAs or dermatologists, okay, we're transferring some money back and forth. The existential issue here is not the relative pay of physicians and PAs. That is an issue. It should be addressed. We should be talking about it, and we should be thinking about it. But if we're simply thinking that this is that one pie, and we're transferring a slice back and forth, we're fooling ourselves. We're not accomplishing what we need to accomplish. We need to say, every time in my life I run into a roadblock, I run into something that doesn't quite work, there's an issue in front of me, an issue ahead of me. What is the micro thing I need to do? What's the macro thing I need to do? And how do I engage with the world around me to make that happen? Because my friends, if we don't do it, unfortunately, nobody will be there to do it for us. So I encourage you to have these questions in the back of your mind. Exit, voice, loyalty. Minimize your neglect. That's never the right answer. Think about the organization around us. Build new institutions, strengthen institutions we have. But really advocate for us, because in the end, if we lose, it's our patients who are going to lose with us. I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you very much. All right, hypothetically, if the U.S. institutes universal healthcare similar to other nations, how would this affect burnout of healthcare providers? So I think if you are able, the closest thing we have to universal healthcare is the VA. And most of the people I talk to in the VA acknowledge that it is a bureaucratic organization that's often frustrating to work with, but they have very, very different issues than we do, right? If you had, from my perspective, I look at a place like the VA as being consistent and very solid across everywhere, whereas we have massive swings in quality and variability across what we do. So there would be issues with compensation and things along those lines, because universal healthcare by its very nature in most countries reduces physician compensation and would therefore reduce your compensation substantially. But as a concept where you say the largest thing is sort of this, the moral injury of not being able to give the treatments that we want, the large overhang of incredibly bureaucratic systems, there's a difference in like that it takes multiple steps to get something at the VA versus I'm being refused, rejected, denied left and right. And I have always a little bit of personal skepticism in moving things to a government-run system, but I think the VA is a great example of something that's done quite well, and I think for the majority of us, that probably would be a better model overall for us to be in. What have I done personally to avoid burnout? So this is a great question. I meditate. No, I don't meditate, right? I don't do any of those things. I think what has helped me the most, right? There's two things, right? Maybe three. One is that I do a lot of different things. I spend a lot of my time doing a lot of different things. I teach, I speak at conferences like this. I do clinical trials. I see patients. I do a lot of research. I work with a lot of young people. And for me, the ability to do many different things is super engaging in a way that as I get frustrated or challenged by one, there's other things that provide me with joy. Each of those different things has a different role. Some of them have more of a compensatory role. Some of them have more of a, it's fun to do this, there's a lot of satisfaction. Others give me a sense of agency that I'm able to help change the world toward the direction that I want, right? Every step at a time, right? On top of that, I do believe that diet, exercise, spending time with family is key. One of the awesome things about being a dermatologist is that like, we're not trauma surgeons, right? We're not there in the middle of the night. We're not doing those things. There's a lot more ease with us. But again, like many of these things that we're talking about, unless we do it deliberately and are active about it, things can get out of hand. It's very easy to layer on obligations and things that we don't like, and end up in a very different place that we want to be. It's like that boat that's like 1 degree off, and then, 100 miles later, or 100, whatever the water distance is, you can tell I'm not a fisherman, you end up in a very different place. So the last piece of advice I would give for that is that I would have a certain time in your life, so you either by yourself or ideally with a spouse, if you're in that position, you take a full inventory of what you do, and then actively say, I'm gonna jettison this, 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 and this, and adjust my schedule or my life or what I do in these ways. It's awesome to do it with a spouse because your spouse often has much more insight into what you do and why you do it and how you feel while doing it than maybe you do. So combination of doing a variety of things, checking in with the spouse, and trying to spend time with loved ones and families. Do I agree that burnout is from frustration and not exhaustion? I think being frustrated all the time is exhausting. Any of us have kids like know that that's the case, right? You're like, how many times do I have to tell you not to do this? You're like, it's exhausting, right? But you're frustrated that you're not getting to where you need to be. I'm not sure that these two feelings are different sentiments. I think they're very intertwined, and I think they're very important. Ultimately, a big part of burnout is an inability to control one's own destiny or future is a major factor for burnout across all professions, right? So if you feel that you don't have control over the world around you, it's very compromising, and that I think is a large part of the frustration, that via frustration can lead to burnout. Going back to my comments about new practices in suburban areas, how can we as PAs actually help improve access to care, which is a huge pillar of our profession? So a couple of things, right? At the individual level, if you have the ability to go to areas where there is less care and less access to care, that would be absolutely awesome and is something that I encourage you at an individual level. That said, individual sacrifice, again, is no way to build a national policy. So you can think about, in your practice, who am I seeing, why am I seeing these people, and can I actively change this ratio, either through deliberate action or through opening additional slots or things along those lines. If your practice itself does not allow it, another antidote for burnout, ironically, is working a little bit more, sometimes in a free clinic or providing care in different ways, right? These, though, are all Band-Aid issues, because the real thing that we need to do is whether or not we move toward the national healthcare system, and as I said, there's some benefits potentially to that, but I have a lot of skepticism in other ways around that, and I think politically we're very unlikely to get to that stage. What we really need to do as all of us, as MDs, as PAs, as however, is to start paying more for the access to care for these places. So even a state that doesn't expand Medicaid, work with them to expand Medicaid. In Massachusetts, we have 99% healthcare access, healthcare insurance coverage, right? That's like 99.2. Of the remaining 0.8, like half of them are people that when they show up in the hospital, we give it to them. The other half are like so rich, they don't want healthcare. But think about how, although again, the de facto experience of getting healthcare is not optimized, at least we have that cardinal piece in place. So people know if they can get in and see us, we can provide care. But we need to improve the compensation, make sure that we're getting paid enough so it actually covers our costs. We don't have to get rich by seeing public patients, but we also can't be subsidizing it every time. So think about individual action and think about your organizations, where you are, the types of patients you're seeing, and how you can change that. But also we have to work to improve the lot overall. Do I think that PA should unionize? I think that anybody who is part of a large system where you are not being heard, it's weird for us because we're usually super educated people. Like this is not the common people. MDs, PAs are not the common people in our society that unionize. But we should think, what is the goal of collective bargaining, right? And it doesn't have to be like a full, like you're going on strike kind of union, right? But the idea of collective bargaining comes from when the power between the employer and the employee has shifted, where the employee is put into positions where they are asked to do things that are not safe, or they can't advocate for appropriate working compensatory conditions, et cetera. I think that's the direction we're heading in, right? I think a lot of us may feel that way, and we're going that direction. So I think that if you're at an institution or organization where you're feeling this way, that option, which I think before was not even on the table, should be considered among any other options where you can put yourself in a position where you can advocate for yourself and therefore for your patients and their situation. How do we improve reimbursement and perceived value in the eyes of insurers for knowledge work? For example, long appointments for complex rashes, which may be reimbursed more poorly than procedures. This is a wonderful question. The hard part is that we share the E&M procedures with everybody. So when you're doing a long visit, you're acting more like a primary care doctor or a rheumatologist or something along those lines, right? So that E&M, that evaluation and management part, the 99214, whatever, that type of stuff, right? 99203, 99204. For new visits, et cetera. Those are like for everybody, right? So if you're a primary care doctor or you're us or you're somebody, a neurologist, you're all using those codes. They're much harder to change because a small shift in those reimbursements will change, it will impact massively the overall cost of care. So what's easier to change is something like actinic keratosis, which nobody cares about, and we can just push and push and push and push up that cost. Because we use it in dermatology as a negotiating tool and we're looking to who to support and how to support and what to do it. We're really the only ones that do that. Maybe some primary care doctors do it as well. So I think the two things we can do to improve reimbursement, the first is to make sure reimbursement doesn't erode, right? I spoke about the AMA yesterday and their work with Congress, not only to reduce this large cliff of Medicare reimbursement, but to try to link Medicare costs or reimbursement with inflation over time. That would be awesome, right? They ideally would link it to medical inflation, which is a different rate than like society inflation, but putting together sort of legislative mechanisms to increase compensation overall would be good. And then the second part is really to think about how we can sort of help support not just dermatology, but the whole house of medicine and increasing those evaluation management fees. We need to do that without taking away from procedures. It's not a this or that. It should not be that way. It should be this and this. We should be able to expand the pie. Do you think that price transparency and healthcare costs could be helpful in reducing the death spiral that we're in? I do think that price transparency has its role, particularly as more young people and more people are moving towards high deductible plans. I think the idea of having a little bit of transparency in what we do would not only provide moral outrage for people that are ridiculous, but also allow people to be smart about how much things cost and what things are happening. I do think we need to be much more elegant in how we provide that information. It's legally mandated to be provided by many folks, and it's almost impossible to get and often out of date. The major issue, though, is that the actual costs are often too high. In my own hospital, we charge a facility fee. I'm not at the hospital, but we pretend like it is, and it generates a massive facility fee for patients. Who benefits from that? I guess I do, right? My salary comes from the hospital, right? Part of my, I'm complicit just by being there, of being a part of this. But that doesn't make any sense, right? There's nothing in the care that we're providing that couldn't be provided in a different setting, right? These are not my decisions or things that I do. But I think having that price transparency, if people stop coming to our clinics because of that, I think our organization would have to rethink that and come up with just better ways of doing that. So in general, price transparency is a major step toward, I think, improving just people's understanding of costs, where the money is going, what they should be doing with it. All right, is that the last one? Okay. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure the last few days. Have a safe trip home to where we were coming from. Thank you very much. Give me the holes in your heart, I promise that I'll do.